From Dark Side of the Moon, Pink Floyd, Us and Them. Beautiful song. Help us get into the proper frame of mind for the next phase of tonight's program. A different way to look and categorize and review strange, unexplained events, unidentified aerial objects, mysterious beings of the multiverse. Dr. Simeon Hine has been our guest on this program several times before. It's my first time to get to talk to him, though. He's written about some of the topics that are near and dear to Coast's heart. This time, however, he takes some eyewitness stories, firsthand accounts of very unusual encounters, and uses them to sort of come up with a frame of reference that he refers to in the title of his new book as Black Swan Ghosts. What is a black swan ghost? We'll find out when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Dr. Simeon Hine is the director of the Institute for Resonance in Boulder, Colorado. Beautiful place. The Institute is devoted to the study of subtle energy sciences, including remote viewing, crop circles, and related subjects. Dr. Hine has a PhD in sociology, previously taught research methodology at Washington State University, and is familiar with many of the kind of topics that we discuss here on this program often. His new book is called Black Swan Ghosts. We're going to find out what that is in just a moment. Dr. Hine, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thanks a lot, George. Thanks for having me here tonight.
You know, you have something in the beginning of the book. I had to go back to it after I read it, in which you say, you know, this at one point in my life, this topic seemed like something you'd be interested in as a teenager, then grow out of as you grew up and became wiser. And you say, it's not something I was looking for. After I read the book, I went back to that page and I thought to myself, well, maybe you hadn't been looking for it, but it seems to have been looking for you.
Yeah, isn't that right? I mean, isn't that true for a lot of us, the listeners to the show and people who get involved in this topic? It's what you're pointing out is something that's really interesting, is that the way we're trained from our schooling and our perspective, you know, as being part of a Western society, is to kind of keep pushing this sort of phenomena away. You sort of think you can get away with that for a while, right? I mean, you hear about stories like this, and you go to conferences and hear about people's strange experiences, strange, quote-unquote, and you think, it's not me, you know, it's someone else. But it kind of keeps showing up again and again, and eventually you realize you need to address this, you know, seriously. You need to take a look at it.
Are there others in your field that study these kinds of topics? I would think it'd be a rich vein to mine. Especially for those who think it's all nonsense.
No, sadly, there are very few academics that study this. I think, you know, Richard Dolan pointed this out quite a while ago in his books about the UFO subject, is that, you know, he came out of political science, and there are very few people that actually look at this. It's really surprising, because you think, I know in sociology there's also Ron Westrum, who's done work in this, but it's actually kind of rare, because I think academics are really afraid of what their peers are going to think of them. It's really a real tragedy in a sense. They want to get promoted. They're thinking about tenure. You know, you're going to get reviewed by your peers. The last thing you want to do is seem kind of strange to them that you're doing something really off the wall. It's really the opposite of what science was supposed to be. You know, it used to be people that were, you know, eccentric and okay being that way, and now people are really kind of very conformist.
It would seem to me, though, they could at least make fun of it, you know, do a sociological study of UFO eyewitnesses or something to declare them crazy, or to explain it away in some other academic way.
Yeah, no, they won't. They won't touch it. It's like the third rail, you know, like Stephen Bassett says, it's the third rail. If you touch it, you get like shocked. It destroys your career. And people are just have been avoiding this subject. I mean, George, I don't think they can get away with it much longer. I honestly don't think so. But it's been something that people have been able to avoid. And academia, I just am so surprised. It's kind of what you said. You'd really think people would want to go after the subject. There's so much there. You know, just in doing Black Swan Ghosts and all the witnesses I encountered, I wasn't looking for them, but they kind of showed up, and I realized they were so credible and so truthful. There are a lot of people out there like that, and it's really a rich area. But people, a lot of professionals want to, you know, play it safe.
Let me talk about you a little bit, and then we'll get into the title and what it means as a way of looking at it, as a frame of reference for these kind of events. You had an experience as a youngster. That's sort of what I meant, whereas this phenomena or this area sort of came looking for you. Do you think the seeds were planted at that instance for what you would do later in life? And can you share with us that the incident, if you haven't talked about it before on the program?
No, actually, I have never talked about it before on the program, and it's very interesting. You sort of forget about these incidents, but what you're saying is something that my mom actually suggested. We were in the Everglades when I was a teenager. My mom was a bird watcher, and we were just walking around looking for birds, as you do, and all of a sudden I saw something that I thought was the moon, but it looked way too green, and it was in the wrong position for where the moon should be. And I said to her, "Hey, Mom, look at the moon. It looks really weird." And she said, "The moon's over there. It's a totally different direction of the sky." And then we both looked back and realized, well, if the moon was over there, what was this thing? It kind of looked like a green cloud. It really wasn't very structured. But we both had binoculars. So we pointed our binoculars up. And there, within the apparently a green cloud, was a structured series of dots in straight lines that formed a Z, like a big Z in the sky. And as soon as we started to look at it, it moved rather quickly into a cloud and disappeared. And then shortly thereafter, all the lights went out, and there was a blackout in that whole area. We went to a ranger talk, as you often do in a national park, at least we did back then, and we sat next to people who had also seen it. But then when we went and told the ranger about it after the talk, she said, "Oh, sure, you know, tell me more." Like, she didn't even want to hear it. And my mom often thought that was some sort of alien craft. I'm not making this up. She said this to me many times, that some did something to us and got me interested in the topic. And who knows, you know, a while ago, I might have thought that was a funny idea, but not anymore.
I mean, did you become obsessed with UFOs? Did you collect all the books? Did you go to all the conferences as a result of that encounter, or just kind of sat there?
No, I really didn't. It kind of sat there. I came across the Mothman Prophecies, you know, John Keel, by accident. Ended up going, you know, to college and studying history and science and things like that, history of science. Then came across Timothy Good's book, Above Top Secret, in the late 1980s in a bookstore in Amherst, Massachusetts. And I really hadn't read much apart from John Keel or Timothy Good. And there it kind of sat until I actually went to graduate school and they completely forgot about the topic. I mean, believe it or not, it wasn't until I came across remote viewing with Dr. Courtney Brown at the Farsight Institute, and I just thought, I can just see what this is about, and it all kind of came back, and I encountered more witnesses, and it kind of opened it up again. But there were long periods of my life where I didn't really have any active interest in the subject, just a really passing interest, I'd say.
So remote viewing is your path back into paranormal, and I'm using air quotes around that word. You heard a radio show in 1996 talking about remote viewing, and then you jumped in with both feet.
Well, sort of. I mean, I heard Courtney talking about it on my local radio station, KGNU, here in Boulder, Colorado. And, I mean, I had just come out of graduate school. I'd been teaching statistics. And, you know, that type of training makes you very skeptical and very critical of anything. I mean, you're really looking for facts and things that can be verified. And there was a part of me that did not find it believable. Another part of me thought, this is interesting. So I thought, just go and check it out, and it's either going to work or it's not going to work, right? But there was certainly a large part of my mind that did not think that the average person could do remote viewing. I mean, absolutely. I just thought, you have to be special, one of these natural psychics, you know, you've seen on TV, police, crime shows, and things like that. I didn't think I could do it, but, George, I was wrong. I could do it. everyone in the class got some results after about a week. I wasn't sure I wanted it to work, but it worked. There's no doubt about it. It worked.
Do you remember what the first test for you that worked, the first result that was confirmed?
Yeah, you know, when you do remote viewing in the beginning, you have these kind of training verifiable targets. You're not looking at stuff really far out and stuff that you can't verify. It's just basic structures, you know, mountains and familiar landmarks on the planet and so forth. And Courtney had given us a picture of Cancun, Mexico. And I remember, it's a blind target. The target's hidden in a folder, and you're sitting in a cubicle. You can't see what it is, and the monitor's not telling you anything about it, apart from giving you cues to just kind of keep you to get writing. And I just started describing it. Each scene, I could hear people speaking Spanish in a hotel, and I took pictures of, like, a cove. And I thought, you know, I'm making this all up. There's no way this has anything to do with the target. This is, like, day two or three, right? A lot of people who take a remote viewing class are going to have this experience. And all of a sudden, you know, okay, session's over, time for your feedback. And there was this picture of Cancun, Mexico, which I had drawn perfectly on the page in what's called phase three. And it was 100% accurate. And I was really shocked. I mean, because, George, you don't know how you do it. I mean, you write the information down in a remote viewing session, but you don't know how you got that information. And it was really quite shocking to have it be that accurate. It certainly wasn't what I expected, but there it was at work.
And you're saying pretty much everyone had the ability to one degree or another in this class.
Yeah, and even the most skeptical people at one point or another would get the best results within one of the targets. It's amazing to see that kind of transformation come over someone, you know, who's very skeptical. I remember, you know, Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ would talk about having skeptics come to SRI, and they would inevitably become very good viewers. It really transformed you in just a week. It was quite remarkable, and it certainly wasn't something that I expected, but there it was. And yeah, everyone, to some degree, would get some very accurate results, which were way beyond what you'd expect by chance. So it showed me that there was some big gap in my educational training, you know, as a social scientist. Something was going on that no one had talked about all the way from kindergarten to PhD about the way the universe worked. And once you see that there's something there that you weren't taught that's real, you begin to wonder, well, what else is real out there in the universe that I haven't been told about?
And I can only imagine as you have that first success and then subsequent successes and are able to do this to some degree, you're dying to tell other people in your line of work, other academics, hey, this is real. You got to check this out.
Yeah, you do. And they haven't actually taken the course. So they're working out of that still very skeptical kind of rational perspective that academics are taught to work with. So you all of a sudden find this kind of distance between you and other academics. They really don't want to look at it. That's why I called my first book Opening Minds, is because that's remote viewing opened my mind to these topics, and I had to accept that there were things that were real that I hadn't been taught about, that you really need to take the time to investigate, look at the information, look at the data, and really read through to educate yourself. Society is really not going to tell you very much about it in the formal education system. And you just realize there are a lot of other topics there, and it's not something you can communicate. George, you can't communicate it easily to other academics. You've seen something different that they haven't seen. And unless it's the type of thing, unless you experience it yourself, you're going to find it very hard to believe that it's real. That's what I found with the movie.
Yeah, I think a lot of things must have changed for you, and it's reflected in your latest book. It's called Black Swan Ghosts. Explain what the framework is, and then in the next segment, we'll get into some of the stories that help you sort of reach this conclusion.
It's coming across a lot of witnesses, starting with being at the Farsight Institute, teaching remote viewing there. I came back and started to teach it, and encountering more and more witnesses from NASA, aerospace engineers, people that would tell you things that they had seen. They might not have told anyone else about this, but they somehow felt comfortable telling you about it in the context of doing remote viewing. It's a cumulative process, and so eventually you begin to hear about more and more of these topics. The black swan idea, you know, comes from the work of Nassim Nicholas Taleb, who, you know, listeners might have heard of. He writes about how we're not very good at dealing with rare events as a society. We like a kind of normal distribution, things that are predictable, things that we can understand easily. But there are a lot of events out there that you can't predict ahead of time. And those are called black swan events, you know, kind of like the credit crash of 2008, where we had this really big flood here in Boulder in 2013, things that happen once every 500 years or once every 1,000 years. But what I thought about this topic, people who've encountered UFOs, unexplained aerial craft, even remote viewing experiences, it's more like a black swan ghost, because you wouldn't even believe that it's possible to begin with. So how do you even talk about it? I mean, we can all believe that a flood would happen or you know, the economy could crash, things like that, that don't happen that often, but they happen. But what about topics like this, topics that are on coast to coast a lot, where it's at the edge of what you even believe is real? It's ghostly, and how do you talk about it? So it's both rare and unbelievable, and that's kind of the framework I found I could explain some of these witness encounters, which on the face of it are just really strange and even hard to talk about.
Well, like the examples you use, the financial crash or, you know, a flood like that. Maybe you don't see the flood coming, but you could have seen the financial crash. There were people who could see the signs of it, and it made sense that it would happen. I guess you only knew afterward. Same thing like with the fall of the Berlin Wall, which is an example you use in the book. And there are signs it would happen eventually. So if you're paying attention, you can see that these things are coming down the road. And that same would be true for UFO, alien encounters, those kinds of experiences.
Yeah, but you often don't see them coming down the road. You know, I wrote about in Black Swan Ghosts, working with East Germans at a research institute in 1989, it was a joint American-Soviet research institute that Brezhnev and Nixon had set up to just find something that the USSR and the USA could kind of cooperate on, you know, climate research. And I worked with East Germans there, and just 5 months before their society ceased to exist, I remember them telling me how comfortable it was and how, you know, if you had a kind of a good relationship with the Communist Party, you know, everything was taken care of and so forth. And it wasn't that bad, basically. Now, this is in June of 89. They didn't see it coming. And that's the way these black swan events are. You won't see it coming until it hits you. Even the financial crash that you're mentioning from 2008, I mean, so many financial analysts right before it happened had given that sort of event like a 1 out of 1,000 year, you know, possibility of happening. It's super rare. But then it happened to us, you know, and it happened more frequently than 1 out of 1,000 years. So basically what it is underestimating risk, and I think that our society continually does this. But with these topics, it's even more underestimated because the potential impact of these sorts of phenomena all of a sudden becoming real, some sort of event that shows people that this, the unexplained aerial craft, if it's another civilization, whatever it turns out to be, that it's actually real. No one will have actually been prepared for that unless we sort of take some action now to educate ourselves.
Not to get too far out into the weeds, but there's a couple of lines in your book where you're talking about the Berlin Wall, the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Yeah.
How strange the circumstances are that led to that event. I had never heard that before.
Yes. Right, it wasn't even something that had, it was based on a rumor, and that's how quickly things can change. You know, when people say nothing's ever going to change, the government's never going to tell us the truth about this, listen, things can change really quickly and just from rumors. And then, as you're saying, at the Berlin Wall, there was just this rumor that they were letting people through from an Italian radio station. It wasn't true, but you had so many people amass at the wall that the guards didn't know what to do, and they decided they just had to let people through.
And so an Italian radio station broadcasts a report, a false report, that they were letting people through. Everybody shows up at the wall, and they just basically give up.
They give up. And it was time to give up. But that, you know, people, if you had talked to academics here in the U.S. or East German specialists, Russian specialists, they would have put that event 5 or 10 years away. Everyone knew it was going to happen someday, that there was going to be unification of Germany. But no one thought it was going to happen in 1989. I mean, I think nobody thought it was going to happen. It was far out. And I think the events that we talk about here on Coast to Coast and things that the audience really enjoys studying and reading about, those things could come at you much faster than you think they can, just like the Berlin Wall fell down. It happened right in front of my eyes.
The financial crisis, the financial collapse, people should have seen it coming, and some people knew it would happen because it was widespread fraud. It was lying on a major scale that could not continue. It makes you worry that it could happen again, given the amount of oversight we have. But people should have seen that coming, and it nearly took us to the brink. You can imagine if something like that could take us to the brink, what something like confirmed contact with some advanced civilization, our superiors, would do. And we're going to get into that and get into some of the stories that you've collected in this book, Black Swan Ghosts, in our next segment. Dr. Simeon Hine is my guest, talking about his book, Black Swan Ghosts, some pretty incredible stories that he's collected from firsthand witnesses, and we'll be right back with more. From 1969's Yellow Submarine, the Beatles, a George Harrison tune called It's All Too Much, which sort of seems to be a theme that we're talking about with my guest, Dr. Simeon Hine. How scientists in general, academics, even sociologists, react to the kind of phenomena that we discuss on this program on a regular basis. UFOs, unexplained craft, alien beings, other elements of the multiverse, which is the subtitle of the book, Black Swan Ghosts. Scientists look at these things, hear these reports, listen to the eyewitnesses. They say in response, it can't be true. We don't want it to be true. Therefore, it isn't. That seems to be the attitude. And the result of this, you would think, would be of great interest to sociologists who study human reactions, and how human beings sort of get through life and deal with reality. We're going to get into some examples of disturbing cases, incidents, reports that has led Dr. Hine to come up with this theorem, Black Swan Ghosts. We'll be right back. Dr. Hine, are you familiar with the Brookings Institute report that was done, I think back in the 60s, that sort of analyzed what the impact would be from a confirmed contact with extraterrestrial or advanced civilization, something like that?
Right, the Brookings report. I think it was 1968 or something.
Right. So they basically looked at this is what might happen if we had confirmed contact with an advanced race, an intelligence from somewhere else. And they predicted that social institutions would basically collapse. We'd be in a world of hurt.
Right. And the other option is that we don't talk about it as a society, and it hurts even more. You know.
Well, that's why I was wondering, do you suppose that there are additional studies that have been done since then, maybe in the black world, in the classified world, to evaluate what would happen and as a possible reason for why our government and other governments are not more forthcoming about these topics?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a good question, isn't it? It seems that a lot of this research has gone into the black world, and it's not being shared with us, and it's extremely, I would just say it's dysfunctional, right? I mean, here we are all paying for this type of research, but we don't get to see what the results are. It's not shared with the public. We can't talk about it openly. Maybe that's what they found, but you know, in the long run, not talking about things also, it's true. These sorts of phenomena could become real very suddenly and cause a type of panic. But by not engaging the topic and not discussing it, when it does come to the fore, as it eventually will, then it could be even more destructive because we haven't been prepared for it. There's no, mental resiliency. I mean, look at the example of the Phoenix Lights, right? I mean, thousands of people see this craft all the way from Vegas to Tucson, and the governor of the state sees it. And yet, there's no discussion about it the next day in the media. The New York Times doesn't report about it for 3 months, right? What's the impact on people's minds to experience something like that, and yet there's nowhere to go to really talk about it? I don't think it's a very positive effect.
I would think that it would be just really tempting for people in your line of work, sociologists, to go ahead and dive into the deep end of this pool to take a look at, to do social modeling on what the effects would be if there was a landing on the White House lawn or any various other scenarios that people have envisioned. It's hard to believe there isn't, but there aren't any.
No, it's George, I like what you're saying. I mean, it would be great if they did that, but these people rely on funding, and they get their funding from the National Science Foundation and these organizations that have decided that this topic isn't real. I mean, I've been a subscriber to Science Magazine for over 25 years, since one of my graduate advisors recommended it. I mean, it's a lot of fun to read it, and I learn a lot. I've never seen any of these topics that I'm interested in, not a single one covered, a single article in any issue. It's almost like there's this line in the sand and you can't go over it. And as a professional academic, you are told somewhere along your training, don't touch these topics. They could hurt your career. Stick with something safe. And so many people buy into that. So we're not getting the research yet. It'd be great. Yeah.
Some of the names that you mention as in the dedication to your book, people like Dr. Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ. I mean, academics who have had the guts to go ahead and forward and dig into this stuff. I don't know. You know, they're still respected within some circles, but I know there are others who think they're crazy.
Yes. And I mean, wasn't it true that Russell Targ, he did a TED Talk and it was banned from TED? They shut down that whole TED Talk channel in Southern California. I mean, even those guys with all their credibility still get censored. And they had a lot of guts, and they also had a lot of funding, right, from the intelligence agencies back in the early 70s. When the government was trying to disprove RV. I mean, that's how it all started. They didn't want it to be real. And like I found out, it turned out to be real, right? That's what Ed May told us, is that they were trying to disprove RV. They didn't want to believe that the Russians could spy on us that easily. But it turned out to work, and that's why they developed the program. But yeah, academics have gotten involved when they've gotten sponsorship to do it. And even then, they had to cover it up, and there were so many critics. So it's always a hot potato.
The stories that you tell in your book, Black Swan Ghosts, are amazing. Give me an overview. Did you set out to collect them? Was it a sort of a systematic collection, or it just you would hear them over the years and file them away?
That's right. I would file them away. It's kind of like we were saying at the beginning of the show. It was kind of like a cumulative effect. I didn't seek out a single one of these stories, George. They all showed up. Either there were people I had known for a long time that finally opened up to me about what their dads, who had been in the Air Force, told them, or what they overheard one night. It's a long process to do this type of research because the witnesses have to trust you. And they're often afraid to talk about this for a variety of reasons. And it takes a long time to get over that fear. And eventually they open up, and that's how you know they're credible, because you've known them for a long time. I didn't seek out a single witness for this book. I just realized after a while, about a year ago, I had encountered so many of these, you know, UAP witnesses, whatever you want to call the phenomena. I can in good conscience not write about this anymore. It's just too many credible people who've told me what they've seen or what they said that their parents told them. And I thought, what in the world is going on here? How many people are like this out here who've seen something and they're not telling us something that's very important for our sense of how reality works? And that's how it came about.
Well, let's talk about a few of them, starting with, sure. I forget what his name is, but he's the jockey, the little guy.
Yeah. Peter.
Right.
This is a guy we encountered going to see. It's a brief introduction. From remote viewing, I got into crop circles because we had some crop circle targets, and I didn't know what they were in the 90s, so I went over to England with a guy named Ron Russell to study them on these tours. And I kept going year after year because I found so many interesting things happening in and around the crop circles. It's a whole other topic for another
That's
night.
Okay. Well, you don't have to breeze through it. Tell us, like what?
Well, there was a lot of strange phenomena around crop circles. I mean, again, I went there partly with my academic mind open to the data, and I found that there were a lot of weird electromagnetic effects around the crop circles. I mean, people reported cameras and batteries failing. I didn't see it happen to my own equipment until the second year I went back in 1998. But every year that I've gone back there, and I've been there for many years since 1997, almost all of them, we always saw very unexplainable camera and battery failure, equipment failure that you just normally don't see, you know, when you're taking pictures on the beach with your camera or wherever you are. All of a sudden you'd be around a crop circle. And that's what kept me going back. And we began to encounter people that had really strange experiences, like this guy, Peter, who was a jockey. And his experience, he told this story many times, and I found him so believable and credible. I have a videotape of it, which I'll put up on the Black Swan Ghost site pretty soon. He was walking with a friend one night over the Downs, which are the hills in the UK, the Downs in Surrey, England, near Epsom. And they're carrying this big gold bust of a Native American. Peter has always been interested in, you know, a Native American culture. And they just see this thing coming down over the hill, flashing every few seconds with this brilliant blue light with a kind of a fog around it. And it made kind of a whirring sound. And as it got closer and closer to the ground, landed, his friends started to panic and wanted to say, you know, said, Pete, we have to get out of here. And Peter was actually kind of interested in this phenomenon. He had some sightings like I had as a kid, so he was a little open to this, and he wanted to wait, but the friend started to panic. Anyway, a door on the craft opens up, and this being gets out. He described it as a very tall being in a skin-tight suit, very athletic build, holding a red sort of light in one hand that gave off light. They weren't sure what it was, and this guy is walking down the hill towards them, and Peter can't wait to meet him, right? So, oh, my God, it's one of these occupants of these craft I saw as a kid. He had seen this over in the Manchester area in the 60s. But his whole town did, he said. Anyway, the panic overcame him from his friend. He said it's like a drowning swimmer, and they ran away. The being turned around and walked back up into the craft. They happened to flag down the first car they can find on the road, and it's a friend of this other guy that Pete's with. And all four of the people in the car and the two of them, see this craft now lift off and shoot off to the horizon. Well, the story doesn't end there, because Peter told me back in those days in the 70s, the police had reporting forms for UFOs, so they stop in the nearest police station. And there's a Bobby, kind of stereotypical Bobby, drinking his tea at 1 a.m. And Peter fills out the form. And, you know, he thinks that's the end of it. And the next day, back at his job in Manchester, just 5.5 hours later, 5 1/4 hours, 6:15, he said, the phone rang. He was already at work at 6:15. The phone rang. It was some man said, Mr. So-and-so, I won't say the last name just to protect his identity, but Peter, about that UFO you saw last night. It was a weather balloon. And Peter said, who is this? And the guy said, never mind who we are. We just want to hear about what you saw. So Peter described it a little bit. And then the guy said, what you saw was a weather balloon. And Peter said, he started cursing. I go, I didn't see no blankety blank weather balloon, you know. The next day, he says that in those days, letters took a long time to get across town, 3 or 4 days. The next day, there's already a letter there from a quote-unquote UFO organization that's inviting him to a conference next week. So, by the way, Peter's friend, he said, was so terrified from this incident, he had locked himself in his room for a week and wouldn't open the door except for food. Okay, so the other guy was really frightened by this. But in any case, Peter gets this letter. His boss gives him time off, and he goes the next week to Manchester to the address. It turns out to be a pub. He asked the pub owner, and the guy says, oh, yeah, there's some guys downstairs. So Peter goes down, and the door's locked. He knocks on the door. They open it up, and he said there were about 30 guys in there, all wearing the same uniform, like a white smock. And it had some sort of military insignia, but he couldn't read what it was, what the identification was. And he said every nationality in the room, in the world, is in that room. He said there were people from China, Japan, Africa. He said it was like a United Nations of people wearing the identical uniforms, each with a pad of paper and a pen. Now, Peter said he thought he was going to a UFO conference or a meeting, so he wanted to hear other people's stories. But what they said to him is, come in, Peter, we want to hear about your sighting. And he was a little disappointed. And then he said they grilled him for 3 hours. Every little thing about that sighting, every blade of grass, what the lights looked like as they flashed, as the took off, what the beam looked like, what clothing he was wearing. And then they asked him to make drawings of what he had seen. And at the end of 3 hours, they said, Peter, what you saw was a weather balloon. Can we keep your drawings? So, you know, like, what sort of organization was that? He thought it was like something like the UN. And maybe the UN has some sort of special access program within it for investigating this. I mean, that's not entirely out of the realm of possibility. But, I mean, such a strange story. That every time Peter's told us this story, you can just feel, you know, the way he tells it. Someone who's really witnessed something like this, you can just see it the way they describe it. It's such a compelling story. And, you know, I have a video of it. It's just a great, you know, just a wonderful thing.
Well, it's, I mean, what happens to him after the UFO encounter is almost as interesting and compelling as the incident itself. I mean, that's almost a Men in Black kind of a episode.
In this case, they're men in white.
Yeah.
So they're wearing these white smocks. It's just bizarre. And, you know, so George, where do you go to talk about this? You know, he's had encountered these people. They told him it was a weather balloon. He knows he didn't see a weather balloon. You know, it was a craft that landed, that flashed. A being got out of it, and yet that's the end of it. There's nowhere to go to talk about it. Some secret government agency is keeping tabs on what people see, and they're gathering data. Obviously, they don't know what's going on either, but they're probably doing their best to find out. And yet you're stuck with a witness like this, and that's why it's kind of ghostly. He let us film him. He was a little hesitant to, you know, let it get out, but he told me eventually he was okay if I talked about it and showed the video.
And he was kind of feisty about it, too. In the book, you say that they told him maybe more than once to keep his mouth shut, and he's not having any part of that.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, at the end, they said, if you know what's good for you, keep your mouth shut. That's exactly right. And by the way, a lot of people on our Crop Circle tour have met Peter over the years. So I'm not the only one who heard this. Every year that we've gone back, he's been gracious enough. Most of the time, I said, Peter, can you tell the story again to this group? And he'll tell it to them the same, with the same kind of intensity. The details are the same. And George, why are they always telling people to keep their mouth shut about this? I mean, that's what you said, and that's what he was told. Well, what is it about this topic they don't want people talking
Well,
about it.
I don't know what would be the point of telling people to keep their mouth shut, because you can say this, you could tell this story, and there's not going to be any consequences. Maybe there would be
Yeah.
for him. Maybe you get in trouble at work or be
Yeah.
socially shunned, but the major media organizations are not going to take it more seriously because there are thousands of other similar stories.
Thousands of other similar stories, yeah.
It's social
No, it's
blindness is the term you use in the book for it, in
social
a sense.
blindness, yeah.
What does that mean from a sociological perspective, social blindness?
Social blindness are things that are happening around us that we find it more convenient not to talk about. And it's kind of self-reinforcing. People know what they're seeing, but they prefer for the right reasons not to talk about it and not to admit that it's going on. And I just know from my own personal family history, because my father's family were, refugees from Nazi Germany. And I talked to my grandmother a lot before she passed on about what it was like to be in Nazi Germany as things got worse. What it's like to be a Jewish German person in Nazi Germany as they would pass these laws, one at a time, very slowly, actually, to gradually strip away rights, from one part of society. And it's kind of creepy, but she described it to me as people that you had known for a long time all of a sudden wouldn't make eye contact anymore in the street, in an elevator. They would ask my grandfather, who was a doctor, to kind of use the back entrance to the house so that people wouldn't see him coming in, because he's Jewish. And it's kind of a slow process where you kind of, something's going on. One part of the society is being stripped of their rights and being turned into second-class citizens, eventually into dust, as it happened. And yet the rest of society is pretending like it's not happening. They just ignore it and it'll
Well,
go
it's like
away. And that's.
literally, almost literally, not confronting the elephant in the room. That's what we're talking about. You,
Yeah,
there's a.
that's the other term. Yeah, that's an easy way to explain it. It's the elephant in the room. And the longer the elephant is there, the harder it is to talk about. And this subject, what we're talking about right here, unidentified aerial craft, the occupants, I mean, it's been with us, 50, 60, 70 years. It's even more harder for average person to confront it because they've been taught that it's not real. And the longer that elephant is there, the harder it is to see.
We'll get back to some more stories collected in your book, Black Swan Ghosts. Lynn Buchanan, one of the best-known remote viewers, you have a chapter devoted to some things that happened to him that I had not read before that I think the audience will want to hear about. And then we'll broaden the conversation to what you mean by cultural lag and future shock. What could be coming next? The Doors take us into the break with a song that seems appropriate at this point, Strange Days. We'll be back with more Coast to Coast AM right after this.